It's 9 o'clock, so we'll get started, but we'll start a little slow as other people come in. Thanks for being here early in the morning. I'm Chet Tezeski. I'm the moderator of this session. It's a session called What's Water Trying to Tell Us? And those of you who've been to the Conference on World Affairs before aren't surprised by a title like that. That doesn't tell us much about what we're going to hear about, but water will be in it somewhere. This session is being recorded, but there are no microphones for questions from the audience. So what we'll do is the producer of this session, who's in the back over there, has index cards. If you have questions, you can write them down and pass them to her, and she'll bring them up. So we'll have plenty of time for questions toward the end. Each of the speakers will speak for between 10 and 12 minutes, and then we'll open it up for questions and discussion. We already went over the questions will be by index card. So our two speakers today, Eric Lindstrom will go first, and Eric is the long title here, Climate Focus Area Lead and Physical Oceanography Program Scientist at NASA. That's a government title for you. He'll go first because he says he actually likes this title and understood the sensitivity of asking a question like, what's water trying to tell us? And then Carrie Emanuel will go next. And Carrie's a professor of atmospheric science at MIT. And it turns out the two of them were undergraduate classmates at MIT sometime in the last century. And I don't know, have you seen each other since?
No, we had a senior class together in 1977, and we met again in a parking lot out here.
Doing a marijuana deal?
Yeah, what better place?
Anyway, with that, I'll turn it over to Eric to tell us what water is trying to tell us.
So I don't know whether water speaks to you, but it speaks to me. As a lifelong devotee of the ocean and passionate about ocean science, I got through graduate school and went to sea for many years and got my name known for being a person who really cared about the salinity of the ocean and trying to get other oceanographers to care about that the ocean was salty. Back a long time ago, they just worried about temperature, but the state of the ocean, salinity is very important. And that's one of the ways that the water speaks to us, by how salty it is. In about 7 years ago, we launched a satellite mission from NASA jointly with the Argentinians to measure the salinity, surface salinity of the ocean from space, which you do by sensing small changes in the microwave emissions from the sea surface. And you have to subtract a galactic background radiation. A map of the galaxy shimmers off the sea surface, and you have to subtract that off to get to salinity. So it's really bizarre, and only NASA could come up with such a thing. We've kind of had this feeling for a long time that we could use the salinity of the ocean to see where water moves on the planet, that when evaporation happens over the ocean, it gets saltier, and when it rains over the ocean, it gets fresher. And if we could follow all that, we could maybe follow the rainfall patterns on the planet. Well, in the process of getting to this mission, we analyzed all the data for the last 50 years of salinity in the ocean. And you get a nice map where it's high salinity in the desert latitudes of the ocean and fresher where it's rainy. And then, but the trends over 50 years were that all the salty places are getting saltier and all the fresh places are getting fresher. And we went, whoa, that's a big conclusion. That's like the fingerprint of what you would find in a warming world. The climate models do that. If you have a warmer atmosphere, you evaporate more water from the ocean, you have more precipitation. And it turns out that it's just sort of accentuates this pattern of dry places getting drier and wet wet place is getting wetter. You can't see it on the continental data, but the ocean has a very generally slow circulation, enough that you can see these patterns build up in the ocean. So that's one way the ocean is speaking to us. The water is telling us something about what's going on the planet. Another one is sea level. You know, how high is the ocean? You think, well, it's creeping up, it's creeping up, and then it's telling us that 90% of the heat from the greenhouse gas warming is going into the ocean, and it's causing the ocean to expand. As it gets hotter, it expands. And so part of sea level is a global warming signal. It's also from the melting of the ice sheets, and we've launched gravity missions from NASA where we can measure the weight of the ice sheets, the Greenland ice sheet and the Antarctic ice sheet, and tell how much water is being melted away from them every year. Greenland is losing, on average, 280 gigatons of ice a year from the ocean melting the glaciers next to the edges. And so it's melting all around the edges. The middle is still frozen. So it's and so we can add these things up. You know, we get a we have overall sea levels going up at 3 millimeters per year, and we know that one millimeter per year is from Greenland melting, one is from mountain glaciers melting, mostly Alaska, and another one is millimeter per year is from the warming of the ocean. So we also know that from all the tide gauge data that a century ago the average rate was 1 millimeter per year over the whole ocean. Now it's 3 millimeters per year. So there's a sense that sea level is rising, it's accelerating. Another thing that the water is trying to tell us, it's trying to tell us, watch out guys, the sea is coming to get you. So by 2100, there'll be 200 million people you know, out of their homes because of sea level rise around the coasts of the world. So that's a big climate refugee problem. I'll put in a shameless plug. We have a climate refugee session later this afternoon over in UMC. Another way that water is speaking is we'd like to know, humans really care about the freshwater. Oceanographers love the sea, of course, but they don't. Nobody lives out there. Here we want freshwater, and we'd like to know where the freshwater is, how it moves around, and NASA will launch a satellite mission in 2021 called the Surface Water Ocean Topography Mission, or we'll measure the surface of the ocean, but we'll also measure the water levels in 3 million lakes on the planet and the flow in all rivers greater than 50 meters wide. So we'll be able to tell where the water is stored on all these lakes and ponds and how it flows in the rivers to the sea. We'll measure this ocean circulation as well. So we'll have this, we'll be listening to every word the water is telling us in the 2020s. So I hope that gets you the message of the session, which is water does speak to us. It tells us a lot. It holds the fingerprints of global warming. It's really critical for us in our future, living near the coast or where our fresh water is going to come from. So I'll leave it there.
I don't know about the rest of you, but I think it's absolutely fantastic what NASA is doing to measure our planet and to measure the properties of water, sea level, and so forth. It's really, really terrific. I'm a climate scientist, and I'd like to tell you, if there's time, two stories of many that I could tell you about how water tells us stories about climate. And I want to begin with the molecule of water, H2O. And it's a diverse molecule for a lot of reasons. And one is that the atoms that make it up, hydrogen and oxygen, come in slightly different flavors. They have different isotopes. Right. So for those of you who've had some physics or chemistry, the number of neutrons in the nucleus of the atoms that comprise it, and so we use those flavors in a very interesting way, and have been for some decades. So One of the isotopes of water has to do with an isotope of oxygen, actually, and the most molecular oxygen is O16, but a very small concentration of the heavier isotope O18 in water. And we can detect that in laboratories. Now, why is that useful to us? Well, when water evaporates from the ocean, the lighter isotope, the normal water, evaporates at a slightly higher rate than the heavier molecules do. So there's a kind of a fractionization that goes on when water evaporates from the ocean. And when that water condenses in the atmosphere into rain or snow, that operates in reverse. The heavier water comes out first. So in the great ice sheets of Greenland and Antarctica, we have a record of snow that goes back, in some cases, 800,000 years, snow and ice. And we can core those, and we can look at the isotopic composition of the water that comprises the ice. That's one of the ways we use that. Now, what does that tell us? Well, basically, it turns out to be a proxy for temperature, because as the water condenses, it first begins to condense at relatively warm temperatures. That's when the heavy water comes out preferentially. And then as it gets further poleward and at colder temperatures, then the lighter water comes out. So it turns out to be a proxy for temperature. So this is one of the reasons we know that the Earth has gone in and out of ice ages, these glacial cycles, roughly 10 times in the last 3 million years, is by looking at the isotopes of water in ice cores. So water literally has been telling us a story about the Earth's climate. Another way we use the same kind of isotopes is in by looking at the composition of the shells of microorganisms that live in the ocean, and when they die, they settle to the bottom. And that reflects the isotopic composition of seawater. So when you have an ice age, a lot of water has evaporated from the ocean to make these ice sheets. And that's left behind, you know, that enriches the seawater and the relatively heavy isotope. And so by looking at the isotopic composition of the shells of the microorganisms, we basically have a measure of how much water has left the ocean and is locked up in ice. So we have a kind of a direct measure of the volume of land ice on the planet. Isn't that incredible? All because water decided to tell us this story, or we figured out how to read the story that water is trying to tell us. Now, I'm a hurricane scientist as well. And my shameless plug is I'm going to be giving a talk this afternoon at 1 o'clock for, I think, 50 minutes on hurricanes. But we actually use isotopes also in hurricanes. And that's an interesting story, too. We would like to know very much, and it's going to be partly the subject of my talk this afternoon, how hurricanes vary with climate. We're changing the climate quite fast now. What's in store for us? Well, one approach to answering that question is to ask, how have hurricanes changed in the past? Well, the historical record of hurricanes is very short and very poor in quality, and it really isn't up to that task, except maybe in the Atlantic. And anyway, you're only going to get at most 100 years out of that. What were hurricanes like in the middle of the last ice age, right? Or what were they like 50 million years ago, when there were crocodiles crawling around Greenland and so forth in the middle of the Eocene period? Well, so we have this new field called paleotempestology, which is an effort to understand the long-term record of hurricanes from the geological record. And there are various different techniques that are used, but one also depends upon this technique using the different flavors of the water molecule. So it turns out that when you measure rainfall in the tropics, and then you measure rainfall in the eye of a hurricane, yes, you can do that. It's not easy, but it can be done, that the rainfall in the eye wall of the hurricane has a distinct isotopic signature. It's relatively light, contains relatively more of the normal isotope of oxygen and water. And so in certain parts of the world, like Belize, that rain, whether it's from a normal thunderstorm or a tropical cyclone, goes percolates down through the soil and gets incorporated in stalagmites and stalactites in caves. And we can go in and section and take out the stalactite and section it There are ways of dating that. And we can analyze the isotopes of those cave deposits. And lo and behold, during the historical period, the big spikes in that isotopic composition line up with known hurricane strikes. Well, we can now go into caves, and these things last hundreds of years, but some of them break off and lie in the bottom of caves and get buried. There are paleostalactites that go back a lot longer. This is just beginning to happen now. It's a wonderful field to be in. So we hope that we're going to be able to construct a very long-term, very accurate record of hurricane activity in many parts of the world because of this particular way that water speaks to us. And I think that's fabulous. I don't know. Do I have a minute or two left?
You're good, yeah.
So I want to just very quickly introduce another water subject to you, which is completely different, which is more not the story that water is telling us, but the consequences of climate change are really felt. The most important consequences for us, I would argue, are felt through water. And Eric has mentioned one important one, is sea level rise. And he also mentioned from the satellite measurements, another very important thing that we had predicted theoretically a long time ago, which is you warm the climate, rainfall gets concentrated in heavier events that are less frequent. And the message, and I'll repeat what Eric said, is that in some sense it's a variant on the poor get poorer and the rich get richer. Usually where it's already dry, it gets drier, and when it's already wet, it gets wetter. And it translates into greater incidences, ironically, of both droughts and floods. Now, I mean, you all know, because a lot of you live out here, the consequences of droughts. But let's take that one step further. If you really want to scare yourself, and I don't like scaring myself, but sometimes we have to get real, read something called the Defense Quadrennial Review that comes out every, I don't know, 4 years or something like that. 5 years. The U.S. Department of Defense is actually very, very worried about climate change. And what worries them most are the consequences of the redistribution of rainfall around the planet. Because history teaches us that wars, migrations, and all kinds of disruptions are often triggered by shortages of water and or food. There are all kinds of really nice examples of this in history. The Middle East is a place which is already marginal for most agriculture, has a fairly large population, and it's drying up. It's already dry. And there are analysts who believe that some of the destabilization we've seen there in recent decades is at least indirectly a consequence of food and water shortages. And so the projections are that if this continues, there's going to be more and more pressure on migrations, more and more incentives to armed conflict. So the people who are serious about the real consequences of climate change, not just that it's going to be a little bit warmer, are worried about the ability of climate change through the water cycle to precipitate geopolitical instability. And those are the problems that keep us awake at night. I'm sorry to end on that black note, but I think we have to be concerned. Thanks.
Great. Thanks very much. So questions, once again, are being taken on note cards. Okay, great. So anyone who has a question can grab a note card or just on your own note paper hand or something, and we'll try and take it on. I have a question while I digest this one. Of all that you've told us, what don't you know now about water that you would most like to know, and why? Mm. This is like a college class, right?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. So I... What we're working towards, what I think our scientific community is trying to understand is how water is moving around in the ocean and on the continents, We have this view of water and how it speaks to us, that it stands in a lake, or you stand by a river and you just watch it, or the ocean is you don't see the motion of the ocean. But all of this motion of the water makes it more difficult for us to interpret how water is speaking to us, because it's speaking over here and then it's speaking over there. And trying to deconvolve the isotope signals, the salinity signals, the sea level signals, really has a lot to do with the motion of water around the planet. And so I think that's one thing that our SWAT mission in 2021 will help a lot more with, is motion both in the ocean and in rivers. Because, you know, it really comes down to basic science, the equations of motion of water and how salinity salts move around or isotopes move around, all involve velocity. And we can't really get the full measure of what water is trying to tell us without velocity.
So one of the my interests is extreme water events, extreme precipitation events, and how do they depend on the climate? So when you look at rainfall in the current climate, as you might expect, if you just count rain events and classify them by their intensity, by how much rain falls, the greater the intensity, the fewer the number of events. But what really affects society are the tails of that distribution. They're rare, very heavy rain events. Now, if you've been here in Boulder for more than a few years, you remember some of the big floods nearby. And dating back, I remember the big Thompson flood in 76. So there's an interesting question about how does the probability of an event like that change with climate? And should we be preparing for that? I'm in the middle of preparing a flood risk analysis for my own campus, MIT. After having done a lot in the rest of the world for years, I thought it'd be a good idea to look at our own backyard, and it's kind of, yeah.
How bad is it?
It's bad because MIT has put so much value underground, and the control room for our nuclear reactor is underground, and it's very susceptible to flooding, it turns out, today, let alone climate change. So, yeah, that's one thing I'd like to know about water.
Yeah, wouldn't we all? Can they fix that?
Well,
moving a nuclear reactor is not easy.
I'm pushing. Well, it's not the reactor, it's the control room.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay, great. Well, one of the questions we got has more or less been touched on, but let me summarize it again. It has to do with the melting of glaciers and the increase of fresh water in the oceans and how that contributes to climate change. And we kind of touched on that in terms of the distribution or the flow of water. But who had that question? Did you get your answer?
Well, there's more. I could add a little bit more. Okay. I had the same question yesterday, so maybe it's the same person trying to get me to give the same answer twice. But so there is a general concern. There was a movie, The Day After Tomorrow, where big event, and there's all this melting in the high latitude, changes the ocean circulation, and within a day there's miles of ice in New York or something. It was crazy. But it's based on the notion that if you melt part of Greenland or more sea ice, that there's more fresh water in the North Atlantic, and that makes the water less dense, and it's harder to make deep water in the ocean in winter. It cools in high latitude, makes deep water. That pulls warm water out of the tropics to high latitude. It makes this overturning circulation, and somehow the melting of the glaciers at high latitudes would shut down this overturning circulation, and places like Europe would have a sudden change in climate. So we're still in early days in modeling this kind of thing, but there are reasons not to be too fearful of this, that the ocean, parts of the overturning circulation, like the Gulf Stream, the big ocean currents, they're driven by the wind, not by so much this temperature and salinity effect. And so the Gulf Stream, there isn't any evidence that the Gulf Stream has changed in recent decades. There's little evidence of change from decades of measurements across the Atlantic of the change in the overturning circulation. So So far, so good. We have time to do better models of the whole circulation and maybe nail this down, but it's not something that keeps me awake at night.
The next question is about fish farms. Are they a viable, sustainable solution to feeding the world's population? And I'll add to that, do you have any thoughts about the pricing or value of water, of fresh water in particular?
I can. So, fish, we're past peak fish for wild fish. So, a lot more and more of what you eat is coming from aquaculture. I like to, science backs me up that we've fished out 90% of the large fish that humans like to eat. We're working on the last 10% to fit large fish in the ocean. So, we depend on aquaculture. It's the main source of protein for a quarter of the people on the planet. So we are going to have more aquaculture, trying to do it in a more sustainable way that doesn't cause a lot of pollution and ruining water is where we need to be, I think. And then the other question was
about
pricing.
Water. Oh, yeah. So water shouldn't be free. It's a limited resource. Fresh water's, when it's free, people take it for granted and take large. I just heard on the news last night that California groundwater has, been taken out in large quantities during the drought, and it collapses the structure in the ground, and they think that the water table won't recover. So it's a one-time thing. You take out all this money out of the bank, can't put the money back in the bank. So this is a consequence of free water.
Okay. Next question is about, is there an understanding of the stability of the glacial and interglacial periods?
That's a really good question, and there is an emerging, I would say there's an emerging understanding of that. During the cold parts of these cycles, there are very rapid spikes upward in temperature followed by a downward spike. There are different classes of events, and we can see this in the geological record. And what we learn from that is that the climate is capable of rather sudden shifts. And frankly, we don't understand that. I don't know of anyone who claims we understand that. Well, naturally, there are a bunch of theories about that. There's another thing that's related to that stability, and that is becoming increasingly apparent, both from studying the Earth's history and from looking at climate models, that the Earth climate is a system that a mathematician would call an intransitive system. That is, it has multiple stable equilibria. If you were to cover the one obvious thing is if you were to somehow magically cover the Earth with ice now, right, it would stay ice covered for a very, very long time because ice is bright, it reflects sunlight. You get into the cold state, you're locked into it. There are ways to get out of it, but it takes many, many millions of years to do that. But it's become evident that there are other states that aren't quite so drastically different from our own, which are also stable in the same solar forcing, same atmospheric composition, are stable. There might be warmer climate states. And this is the point of trying to do basic climate research, and it's something I've been pushing for a long time. Let's not just focus on the current problem with warming. It's very important. We have to work on that. Let's try to understand the much longer term, more basic fundamental science of climate.
This session, by the way, goes to 9:50, so we have about 20 minutes left. So any more questions, bring them on up. And I should have said this earlier, but we especially welcome questions from students. So maybe if you are a student, put your GPA in the upper right-hand corner. This one is from a student finishing a PhD in hydrology who says that water tells me that we have to rapidly reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So how do we more effectively use science of water as a narrative to get people to drive less, consume less, and fly less? we need a sociologist for that.
Yeah, I think we do need a sociologist for that. But yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things we climate scientists and our associates, maybe in communication and sociology, haven't been so great at is to really communicate in a more detailed way that one can actually imagine what the real risks of climate change are. We like to talk about global mean temperature doing this and that. Okay, fine. It's something we can measure. It's something the models are relatively good at predicting. But who cares if it's a few degrees warmer? That isn't the real risk per se. Actually, there are risks that are associated with temperature, but they're not the big ticket items. The big ticket items really are those that involve water, the sea level, and so forth. And people understand sea level. What I don't think they understand, and I don't think we collectively understand very well, is the destabilization, the geopolitical destabilization that occurs when the distribution of water changes. History teaches us that. This is not all theory. Whole empires have collapsed because of local or perhaps global climate change, because of shortages of food or water, sometimes brought about by mismanagement of those, often brought about by mismanagement of those resources. So yeah, whoever asked that question, I think it's a very good one. And we haven't done a good job using water to communicate what the really big risks of climate change are.
So from my perspective, I think water supply is the main issue for the 21st century in terms of change, impact on people. I think hydrologists and the science of hydrology, you'll be the rock stars of the 2020s. NASA is trying to bring hydrology, surface water hydrology, into the space age and make it a global field of endeavor. It's mostly a local. It has been a local studies. And to put the global picture together, I think it's going to dawn on people that our fresh water is a precious limited resource and that we'll be protecting it a lot more. And hydrologists will be at the center of that.
The next question is one I think probably we all have on our minds. It's it's to discuss the backup plans as budget cuts hurt climate, and I'd add water research.
Well, I'll just give you a little bit of perspective on that. It is a rough time for climate science, no question about it. They're talking about large cuts in climate research. There are some places, some states, where government employees can't even use the phrase climate change. It's a pretty strange period. But water also, obviously, plays a really important role in day-to-day weather. And one of the intellectual advances in the field of climate over the last two decades has been to recognize that there's a virtue in a climate model and a weather forecast model being one in the same model. And that concept we call unified modeling. And it was, frankly, came out of Great Britain, not the United States. But they've got a lot of mileage out of this. You could sort of think of it this way. If a model can't forecast the weather, why would you trust it to forecast the climate? It's a bit naive. But if it doesn't forecast the weather, it's not likely to be a very good climate model. If it does do a good job with weather forecasting, it still might not be a good climate model. But so it turns out that the very people who are decimating climate research in Congress and in the executive branch happen to be wildly enthusiastic about improving the United States' ability to do weather forecasting. Finally, because we've been pushing them for decades, we are well behind the Europeans in the quality of our numerical weather forecasts, but demonstrably and quantitatively. And we've been trying to get Congress interested in this. We have much more at stake economically in weather than does Western Europe. Just do. We have more violent storms, hurricanes, tornadoes, and so forth. And yet we spend less in some normalized way on weather forecasts. So Congress just last week passed, for the first time in a long time, a bill I mean, Congress actually did something. To me, that's miraculous, right? And they did it in a bipartisan way, because this turns out to be very bipartisan. Both parties want to improve weather forecasts. Isn't it lovely that weather hasn't been put into this terrible drama of politics yet? Anyway, they passed the bill, and we're really going to up our efforts in weather forecasting at just a time when laboratories like the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory at Princeton are anyway retooling to get into the weather forecasting business, because that is a route to improving climate models. So what we're going to be doing, I think, is great weather forecasting models that are also stealth climate models. Just don't tell anybody.
Yeah, so as the climate focus area lead at NASA headquarters, I lead a stealth climate program. It's not really... a lot of the fighting is over a word. I'm not going to go do battle with anybody in Washington over one word, climate, or climate change. We can do our work by studying water, air, atmospheric composition, the cryosphere, all these things we do, and they add up to that word, climate, and just fine. So my job is basically observing the environment. NASA gets a little bit of a pass on some of this political debate because we're not a regulatory agency. We don't make policy. We're just the facts. We're like Jack Webb and Dragnet, just the facts, ma'am. You know. So it's really as long as we stay there, and we do try and stay there. I know the present administration is, you know, pushing back on climate, and a lot of NASA's research highlights that we just submitted to them were about climate, and there's some pushback on that. We say, fine, we can. And you know, our bosses are, it's not censorship, but we can reframe these things so that they don't sound like climate. And that's easy. So it's like, okay, that was really good feedback, White House. Thank you very much. We'll go with it. So that's our reaction. I'm not losing sleep over the budget. You know, if we have a bad budget every year, once, you know, in a year or for 2 years, we survive. NASA's in it for the long term. And, you know, 10 years of bad budgets is deadly. But, you know, politics swing at a much faster rate than that.
Can I just ask Eric a quick question about it? So, Eric, during the campaigns and maybe a little bit after that, there was at least a lot of statements floating around that NASA was going to be asked to look increasingly outward and to basically scale back its observations of the Earth. Is that something we should, as citizens, be worried about, or do you think that's not going to materialize?
Maybe it will materialize in some smaller way. I don't think there'll be a wholesale... 10% of NASA is looking back at the Earth. The Earth Science Division makes up 10% of NASA. So when they say NASA is getting a 1% cut in Trump's slim budget, that's really saying that Earth science is getting a 10% cut. Well, if it's just 1 year, 2018, and then there's an election and Congress is different, you know, we'll survive a 10% cut in 1 year. We were always ready to manage that sort of change. You know, if the priorities of the country change, We can back off to a core program that will keep us going. But there are a lot of missions and things that they're 15 years in the planning, 10 years in the execution. The time scales to do these missions are very long, and so we have to be resilient at any large changes over a year or two.
I was going to ask you to elaborate on this, the question of research funding. Naturally, we focused on the U.S., and you touched a little bit on Europe, but what about the emerging economies, China, India, and other hybrid approaches, private philanthropy? Do you have any insights about who else is interested in this and how else we can answer the questions that we need to ask?
Well, so in the water world, Almost all of our satellite missions are done with other nations. Our Salinity mission with Argentina, who has a small space program. Our surface water ocean topography mission is joint with the French Space Agency, CNES. They're about a third of, it's a $1 billion mission, so they put in a third of $1 billion. That's a big, and they're very interested in the freshwater aspects of the mission. China has a very vibrant research program. They're very interested in agriculture and water and all the measurements associated with that. India is the same. Brazil has a space program. Nigeria has a space program. There's a lot of research going on. The scientific world, especially oceanography, is so international. There are no borders in the ocean. We don't feel like there are borders in the scientific community. We're like one community. I wish we could take that notion and spread it across all of humanity. We'd be a lot better off. But scientists don't seem to have the political conflicts that nations do.
That's for sure.
The next question is from a student who asks, how does the meat industry impact water usage?
Very far from my expertise, I don't really have much to say about that, except that I understand that whole industry is very water intensive and that it's not necessarily a very good use of resources, but I'd be the last to claim to be expert in that. Eric, you want to?
No, I think, on the land-based side, meat is a big user of water. I kind of have this feeling that aquaculture is a big user of water, a polluter of water, changing the water environment in coastal regions. And so we need to move beyond pigs and cows and think about the protein that we're growing in the ocean and its impacts as well.
I'll just add something very quickly to that. One of the very recent innovations that's sort of underway is to try to do aquaculture at sea rather than using freshwater. That is to basically farm plankton and use that to make fuels. And in fact, apparently there's several techniques under discussion where they can actually capture some existing carbon in the atmosphere by doing that in a permanent way. So that there's a lot of innovation going on in technology, and not all of that gets out to the public.
Can we make water?
The Earth makes water. It's called juvenile water. So we have youngster water. It comes up in the hydrothermal vents in the ocean. So the Earth's mantle is disgorging small amounts of water all the time. And so we know about that. It has a particular helium signal. We can see the plumes of it in the ocean by measuring helium in the deep waters of the ocean. So you can see the plumes of juvenile water in seawater.
I'll just add to that we can certainly make fresh water out of salt water, desalination. And I don't know very much about that either, except I do know that there are parts of the world which are doing this on a massive scale, including Israel. It's getting a lot of its fresh water now from desalination, and the technology is apparently improving. I don't know if you wanted to add to that.
Yeah, so it's a good side for water supply. It's relatively energy intensive, so you need some good energy source to do it. And then it also has a downside, which is produces a lot of highly salty water, which you need to dispose of. And anytime we think of disposing things, we think of the ocean. It seems like, oh, out there, let's put it out there. And we have to worry about how that will impact our coastal waters, which are coming up to bite us.
Yeah, the out there part. My wife always complains whenever we go to San Francisco and we stand out on the Golden Gate Bridge and look out toward the Farallone Islands. I tell her about the radioactive barrels out there. This question is about ocean garbage patches. What's the impact on ocean chemistry?
Wow.
Yeah. So the last 5 years or so, I've been a big sort of advocate for research on plastics in the ocean and understanding the so-called garbage patches. There are places in mid-latitudes in all the oceans where there is a convergence of ocean currents and plastics and debris tend to accumulate. The pattern is a lot more complex than that. It isn't just a bunch of stuff accumulating in one place. There's plastic all over the ocean. Different size classes tend to accumulate in different places and different windage items. And so we use the ocean circulation models to predict where things are going to go and wind up so we can predict where the garbage patches are now. They're so diffuse that you might not even see them. You would go out to some place that was in the middle of the ocean where there was supposed to be a garbage patch. You would put a net in the water with a fine mesh, and you would capture a lot of microplastics, but you wouldn't see any big pieces. It gets broken down over time. So they're not islands of garbage out there. Rarely there are, but it's not really what you would see going out to sea. I spent years of my life out at sea, and you crisscross these places, you see floating bottles and things, and there's garbage everywhere. There's a lot more garbage now than there was 30 years ago. There were a lot more fish 30 years ago, and now you see a lot more garbage than fish. You used to see a lot more fish than garbage. So it's not a good thing that we're doing 8 million metric tons of plastic into the ocean every year. We're starting to compete with the mass of fish in the ocean, the amount of plastic that we put into the ocean.
What's the strangest thing you saw floating around out there?
The Japanese tsunami has brought everything of humanly possible into the North Pacific, and it washes up on Hawaiian beaches still with quite regularity. Tires and cars and barges and boats and nets and, every household item, anything you can think of that people use on land winds up in the sea in some form. Dumping at sea from ships was banned in the 1980s. So almost all the plastic and garbage in the ocean does not come from people out on the ocean. It comes from land. So that's something to know, that you own the problem, not the mariners.
We've just got a couple minutes left. I think this might be our last question. Sorry about that, but thanks for participating that way. Can you say something about whether increasing ocean acidification will affect rainfall and salinity trends?
It's a big problem, ocean acidification, but I haven't come across anything that suggests that will directly affect rainfall patterns. It's mostly a problem for marine ecosystems. Of course, the climate system is a very nonlinear system. Everything ultimately is tied to everything else, but I don't think there's a direct effect.
So there is a sort of a connection between ocean acidification. That's carbon dioxide dissolves in seawater. It makes carbonic acid. And so the oceans get acid the higher the partial pressure of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. In order to understand the carbon in the ocean and the acidification effects, you need to know the salinity really well. So with the advent of our salinity mission at space, we've been able to make much better maps of the total alkalinity part of the carbon cycle in the upper ocean. So these things are connected, but there isn't a direct relationship between ocean acidification and evaporation, which leads to precipitation, or ocean acidification and the sea level, or any of these other things. It's really mainly an impact on the biology in the ocean, the reefs and the plankton. So that's another pressure that we're putting on the ocean.
I'll just ask one last question, squeeze in one more, but it is 9:50, and anyone is welcome to go, of course. But how much carbon have the oceans absorbed, and how much more can they absorb?
Well, I'll just give an introduction to that problem. In very round numbers, about half of the carbon we put into the atmosphere now resides in the ocean. So it is a buffer. But as you increase the carbon dioxide dissolved in the water, you change its chemistry, and you change its biology and its ability to absorb carbon dioxide. And the current thinking is that as you keep doing this, the ocean's ability to absorb carbon dioxide would actually diminish over time. But that isn't considered an entirely solved problem. So my perspective is that you certainly don't expect that ratio of buffering to go up over time. The fact that the carbon now, half of it resides in the ocean, is very problematic, as we just discussed, because you, at some point when you increase the acidity of the ocean, it becomes problematic for marine organisms that build shells to do their thing. And we've already, in other ways that you've heard about this morning, decimated the biology of the ocean in terms of the larger species of fish. So it's problematic, and that's my perspective.
Yeah, we knocked off the top of the food chain in the ocean pretty well already with industrial fishing. Now we're going after the base of the food chain with ocean acidification. So we've increased the acidity of the ocean by 30% since pre-industrial time. So it's highly measurable, obvious, significant, and by the end of the century, many parts of the food chain will be in deep peril.
Well, please join me in thanking Eric and Perry.